Welcome to Educated Conjecture, an Ipsos podcast that combines what the public thinks with what the experts think. Each week, Ipsos's Mike College and Sean Simpson are joined by an informed guest to discuss a current or emerging issue. In this episode, hosts Mike and Sean are joined by their public affairs colleague, Siam Sethi, to drill down into the Canadian data from the recent Global Trends study. Together, they explore the data that shows how the country is changing and how Canadians feel about the impact of constant disruption and evolving technology, as well as issues affected the most by the say-do and believe-true gaps. And now, on to the podcast.
Welcome to Educated Conjecture. Sean, how are you today?
I'm good, Mike. I'm 4 days from holiday, so I'm really good.
4 days from Hawaii.
Yeah, that's right. It's aloha.
Aloha. Yes. I'm 4 days from February in Ottawa, which is not going to be Hawaii. I haven't seen you in a little while. We haven't done a podcast in a little while.
That's right. We got to get back on our schedule, I think.
Yeah, we've done a couple other ones. You've left me solo. I thought you might abandon me today, too. But instead, you brought a friend.
I did.
Hi, Siam Sethi. How are you?
I'm good, Mike. How are you?
I'm very good. For those of you who don't know Siam, she's a vice president in our Toronto office in public affairs, one of Sean and I's colleagues. Mm-hmm. And she's joined us today, because I don't know if you guys know this, but not too long ago, I had a good chat with Nick Chiarelli, who heads up our Global Trends, or heads up is one of the leaders of our Global Trends group. And he and I had a very good talk about our Global Trends study, which is coming out in February, the Ipsos Global Trends study, which covers 50 countries, 40,000 people, 70% of the world's population, and I think 87% of the world's economy. So it's a pretty big study. So Nick and I had a great conversation about as broad a trend you can get into with 50 countries. And I'm hoping today that we can dig in, if you guys are keen, to some of the Canadian data.
I would love to. And just to stroke Siam's ego a little bit, to thank you for coming on the show, I did want to mention that she was recently named as one of the top 50 women leaders of Toronto. And what do leaders do? They can tell the future. So that's why we've invited her to talk about trends and what some of this means for Canada looking into the future. No pressure, though, Siam. No pressure.
No pressure. She also works on her Context Next study, which looks 10 years forward in the future. So she should really be able to tell us what's going to happen.
Absolutely. Thank you, Sean. Thank you, Mike. I'm very excited to be here, and I cannot wait to talk about what our Canadian data is showing us.
All right. Well, let's jump in. For those of you who don't know, I'm sure you'll all run right away to check the Global Trend Study, which will be posted later in February. As I said, it covers 50 countries. It looks at the sort of the global macro forces, and then drills down into, you know, a dozen or so trends that are driving sort of markets, countries, individuals, people, everything today. But I'm going to just pick on 10 numbers that we thought were pretty important. So let's start off with Sean, Siam, jump in whenever you want. The first one, and sometimes I'm going to pick two numbers just because I like to be controversial. 6 in 10 Canadians, 61%, say they are happy, but almost the exact same proportion say the country's on the wrong track. So how do you reconcile that personal optimism or happiness with I don't like the place I live necessarily?
Well, you know, it's interesting because when we used to look at some of these fundamental metrics, they moved in lockstep. They were highly correlated: government approval, happiness, whether or not things were going in the right track or wrong direction. But we're now starting to see a divergence. So you can be personally happy but not happy with the way the country is going. And I'm wondering, this sort of detachment from those two, is it the function of the fact that governments can't seem to keep up with the kind of challenges that the world is facing? Maybe people are seeing that government is having less of an impact on their lives, and so they can be happy even if they're not necessarily happy with the way the country is going.
It's really interesting that, you know, we see such, you know, contradictions. And if we know anything, we know one thing: humans are complicated, right? We are very much capable of holding multiple opinions which are in conflict to each other, right? So that's what we're seeing here. But if I also talk about future casting and predicting our assessments of, you know, how is my personal situation going to look like in the future, or how is my country doing right now or will do in the future? Sean, you know, alluded to our Context Next study where we, you know, forecast trends and patterns over a period of a decade. And if I talk about that, what's happening here is that fewer Canadians over time are predicting an optimistic picture of their future and of their country. And that's does talk about, you know, long-term optimism and long-term dampening optimism too. So there is something which is, yes, we are on the wrong track, but are we also going to be on the wrong track?
Yeah, that's a good point. I know this is about Canada, but this data does mirror what we've seen over the last couple of years in LATAM as well, where people generally say, you know, crime, corruption, the economy is not going in the right direction, but I and my family are going to be okay. So there's that, you know, personal optimism that you, it's very hard to say, I think my future is pretty bleak. And so maybe we're starting to see some of that in Canada as well. All right, do you want to jump to another stat?
Yep.
Okay. So 7 in 10 Canadians, bang on 70%, are worried that government and public services will do little to help people in the years ahead, which I found this one a little bit surprising, given we're not that far post-pandemic when we were, you know, loudly and rightly so touting the merits of the public sector, hospitals, frontline workers for saving us or getting us through the pandemic. What do you guys think?
There's so much to unpack here. Like I could spend hours talking about just the healthcare sector, right? We know that there is a crisis of confidence happening. And we see that, you know, the public is losing trust in healthcare and our government's ability to, you know, make good on the promises or even to remedy what's the damage that has already been done. We've seen numbers change so fast in such, you know, short period of time that it's really shocking. Barely 54% give positive ratings to the quality of healthcare that, you know, you or your family have access to in the country. And that's disturbingly down by 18 points in the last 2 years. So that speaks to, you know, really, it's a crisis of healthcare confidence.
The pandemic, of course, was prime time for government intervention, right? And they acted quickly, they moved swiftly, perhaps even did too much to sort of soften the blow of the pandemic. But things are changing quite quickly. And the question that I have is, you know, how much of this is that governments won't versus can't? Are they simply unable to help anymore? Have they lost their ability through policy, through taxation, through incentives, whatever the case may be? Have they lost their ability to solve problems? Or is it simply just too politically inexpedient to do so? You know, the healthcare, for example, we know that from polling that was out recently that many have opened the door to the introduction of more a private delivery, but publicly funded. Will governments take the plunge and risk their own future, their electability, by going down that route? So, you know, Mike, curious to know if you think it's that they can't fix it or they just simply won't.
Well, it's, you know, we've asked the questions and we focus an awful lot on trust, as you know, Sean, and, you know, do you trust whomever or trust different organizations to fulfill their mandates? But we also ask about capability, and we've seen a decline in capability for governments to solve big issues, particularly over the last year. So I think it's a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B. I would argue that trust is probably easier to turn around than a loss of confidence in the capability side. You can trust, you can reaffirm that. But once you think that someone's not capable, it's like you trusting me to dunk a basketball. It's very unlikely that I'm capable of, no matter how much you think I'm going to try my best.
Well, if Canadians don't believe that government's able to actually step in and fix some of these things and they're not deriving value from government, maybe there'll be calls for smaller government in the future.
Yeah, could be.
Or it, you know, it puts the responsibility and there is a need gap for businesses to step in and, you know, deliver on customer expectations.
Yeah.
Citizens are also customers.
Well, and there's a desire for both citizen patient, well, about both, all citizen patient consumer empowerment. I want to make my own choices. I want to make some decisions. If the government's not going to be there for me or systems aren't there for me, you know, that's, and we saw this start to rise. What, the 2008, 2009 recession, we started to see do-it-yourself wills, do-it-yourself, sell your own home, all those things come up as cost savings. So anyway, we might see more of that. You guys both alluded to number three. I don't know if you know this or you were planning or thinking ahead, but while you were talking about the last one, or you've said it a couple times, things are changing really fast. In fact, 68% of Canadians say the world is just changing too fast.
I think the reason that many feel this way is, and it's showing up in our data, significant groups of people feel like they're being left behind. So it's not necessarily that change is bad. It's just that change is bad if it doesn't include me. And, you know, we talked a lot about the K-shaped recovery. Mike, you said, I think it's not K-shaped recovery. It's now the K-shaped economy. You know, as a new normal, more people are being left behind now financially. We know from a lot of the research that we do on technology and technology adoption and people's level of confidence with technology, for example, that it's not necessarily a generation divide. There's a huge gender divide there. Women, yes, younger women more likely to feel like they're being left behind when it comes to technological inclusion and innovation than men. So completely understand we change things and it benefits the few who are able to keep up, but those who aren't able to keep up just feel like they're falling behind.
Yeah, and Canada is one of the least likely in the world to feel this way, by the way. So it's only, you know, behind Sweden and Great Britain. So Canadians are lesser likely than most people to feel that, you know, the world is changing too fast. So we are actually doing somewhat better than other countries.
Well, 68 is not a ringing endorsement.
Yeah, that's an interesting challenge. And I think, Sean, you're onto something about people feeling left behind, and it does, it has felt. I mean, there's almost like an unrelenting wave after wave of change, right? Just waiting for the next normal, but there's always something that's disrupting it. So, you know, maybe we're living in just more disruptive times, and we'll eventually numb to it. So, all right, on to the next one. 8 in 10 Canadians believe it's inevitable that they will lose some privacy in the future.
Well, I want to talk about that. I mean, just the sheer convenience, the value that we draw out of trading our personal information. If I don't resign to that as a necessary evil, how will I say, you know, okay, Google, change the temperature to 23% while I'm still in bed? Or, you know, how will I ask Google to, you know, switch on the lights or do other cool things around the house if I don't let them, you know, listen to all my family's conversations all day long? So I have to sort of give up that, you know, personal information to get the conveniences technology is offering. So yes, people do feel that, you know, it is inevitable, and 81% is a high number. We are becoming more and more acceptive of trading this information for conveniences.
And I think this is another area where there's a huge generation divide. You know, it's interesting because time after time we do studies, and the drivers of trust are often security of data, privacy, etc. But then when we ask people if they're willing to share their information, in particular younger people, are like, yeah, but it needs to be for some benefit. And that benefit may be more than convenience, but maybe some financial benefit as well. For example, maybe your bank is better able to tailor products or services to you that meet your needs. Maybe you will receive marketing advertisements for products or services that you use more as opposed to useless ones. As data becomes more commoditized, and I think people are starting to understand that their own data has value, it'll be up to those who want to acquire that data to demonstrate what value it gives to the average person. So a lot of people, you know, think it's inevitable they're going to lose privacy, but they want something for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and they also, you know, you may think it's inevitable. And we've had this with discussions with people who are like, but we've got a great sort of legal agreement that we put in place so that we're okay, but you're not spared your reputational challenges, right? Even if people accept that it's going to happen, that when it happens to them, they want to have some compensation. They want to know that you're adjusting it to be protected. They want you to take responsibility. So yes, it may happen, but that doesn't absolve anybody on the back end of it.
And it does absolve citizens of, you know, the worry. The worry still remains, yes. Right? We see that 65% of Canadians say that I'm still really worried about privacy and security of my personal information. And majority continue to, you know, believe that the data should be owned by the citizens. So
yeah, that's those interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's the leaking, but then there's the ownership of it. And that's starting to see people start to, in some places, try to figure out how you can commoditize that, how you can sort of can make get something back for your own data. But we're still a little ways off on seeing it on a mass application. Okay, on to number five, almost three quarters, 73% of Canadians believe we're headed towards an environmental disaster, unless we change our habits very quickly, but we don't see them changing their habits very quickly. What gives?
So many gaps there, right? We see all this buzz with, you know, COP26, then COP27, every year leaders get together, eat nice buffets, and they talk about what can be done, but do we see the needle move? That's questionable, right? There's when it comes to individual action, there's always been the say-do gap. I say that I'm going to act responsibly, I'm going to buy, you know, I'm going to spend more money to buy the greener products, but when it actually comes to, you know, my affordability to do that, that I might not end up prioritizing that, right? So there's the say-do gap, but what we're seeing increasingly is also the believe-true gap. I don't know if you've heard of this.
Enlighten me.
Well, the believe-true gap is where, you know, we see this lack of understanding of what are the actions that are actually, you know, very heavily polluting versus those which are, you know, low effort, but also low impact. And we see that, you know, the understanding is very lacking. Things like, you know, meat industry, we know that it's meat and dairy is one of the heaviest, you know, contributors to greenhouse gas emissions. And yet we see that, you know, that's listed at one of, you know, the bottom most actions that people feel that, you know, should be prioritized. We talk about circular economy, which is, you know, repairing, reusing, or refurbishing, recycling. Those are the lowest impact ones. But people feel that, oh, yes, I recycle. I'm doing a lot for the environment. But I also take like 5 flights during the year, which is, you know, environmentally damaging.
Like Hawaii.
Well, come on. I can't take a canoe. We need more public shaming. That's what we need.
That's what we need, more public shaming. Yeah,
that's right.
Well,
that's right.
Thanks, Mike. Sean, have a great time in Hawaii. And
going to Hawaii is fine. Just don't fly.
Yeah.
And don't sip pina coladas in plastic disposable cups.
No, it's Mai Tais. It's Mai Tais in Hawaii. I was just going to say quickly, you know, Canadians say they're willing to play their part. But they already think they are. And as Sam noted, many of the activities that they do are not inconsequential, but pretty small, you know, actions in the grand scheme of things. So we have to move and say, okay, what more can we ask of Canadians to do? What's the new reduce, reuse, recycle mantra? Because we've been, you know, that one was ingrained in us as kids in the 80s. And, you know, we all do that. And we're like, hey, because we do that, we're doing enough. But there is so much more that needs to be done, but nobody has articulated it in a clear, concise way. There's been no clear call to action everybody can get behind. And I think once we figure that out, then Canadians may be a little bit more willing to adopt a new way forward.
Do you think that we haven't figured that out because we've just been playing politics with the file for too long?
Yeah, it's like hot potato, right? Are we doing carbon taxes or are we not doing carbon taxes? Next government comes in, they, you know, they undo the things that the previous government did, and the yo-yo just kind of goes up and down and the pendulum goes back and forth. Once again, back to that, is it that they can't or that they won't? Yeah, I think on climate change, it's that they won't, and it's politically inexpedient to make the tough decisions.
I was just going to say, I think we can all agree that there has been a lack of, you know, consistent narrative being pushed to the public that this is what you need to do and this is our commitment. And so, yes, there is sort of a chicken and egg problem. And, you know, people are still looking up to the government on, okay, you tell me what I need to do because I'm confused. Yeah.
Well, and we know from all of our stuff on, and we'll jump to the next one in a sec. When it comes to paying for it, people are like, yeah, there may be more cost to fixing climate change, but it is not a public or a consumer cost. It is government or business that should share that cost and bear the burden after some 20 years of you saying that it needs to be fixed. Please do. I want to flip gears and talk a little bit about values, because 70% of Canadians say that they expect that there's going to be more and more conflict in Canada between people who don't share the same values.
Well, and this one is really fundamental. You know, social cohesion in Canada is low. It's getting lower. At the start of the pandemic, we were much higher than the United States in terms of how cohesive we felt as a country. And now we're about the same, if not lower, than people in the United States. And the decline of social cohesion, I think, is one of the more fundamental transformations that Canada is undergoing right now. This used to be a differentiator for us, that we were able to prioritize the collective over the individual. But I think it no longer is. And some of the real core fundamental policies that we have here in Canada, equalization payments, immigration, OAS, CPP funding, all rely on social cohesion and me feeling like I have something in common with somebody who lives in Fort McMurray.
Mm-hmm. Don't know we'd get them today. I don't know that we could build some of the social programs today. I get collectively as a net, they help the majority, but individually, they almost always help a plurality. And it's hard to see a path in today's climate where if you were a government saying, I want to craft something like this, where you could get, I mean, we got the dental benefit, but they didn't roll up banners to say that's fantastic on a high level of Canadian. So sorry, Siam, I stole your window there.
That's completely fine, Mike. The only thing I'll just add is, you know, what Sean was talking about earlier, if you add the K-shaped recovery to it and the growing inequalities and the feeling of some people benefited more from this and, you know, I have lost out, that further, you know, accentuates this. Are we in this together? You know, it's like I have to watch for my own sentiment. And that's what's really happening and worsening.
Oh, good point. Okay, I'm going to jump to the next one so we can keep on track relatively. Despite what we see in terms of support for ethnic diversity and multiculturalism, we're starting to see, I think, some cracks in the facade around immigration. And today, 40% of Canadians believe there are too many immigrants in the country. What do you guys think?
Well, I think this is a very important topic, and it's going to shape the way our economy, starts to grow towards in the coming time. We have the reputation of being, you know, welcoming immigrants and valuing multiculturalism. You know, foreign-born people make up about 1/5 of Canada's population, and that's one of the highest ratios for industrialized Western countries. So we are on that path. The government has announced aggressive plans to take in, you know, 500,000 immigrants a year in the next 5 years. So we're talking about, you know, developing and shaping our economy in a certain way. So this one is really important. And so far, we've seen that, you know, that sentiment, we are welcoming, but it could very quickly change if the support structures don't keep up. And right now, we spoke about this. We are already, you know, hearing all around us that the government is really failing us. It's not delivering on infrastructure promises or service promises. So if that continues, this sentiment is quickly going to change. It's already at 40% believing that we have too many immigrants. And this is a space that we really need to, you know, watch out for, because it could quickly lead to growing opposition and unrest.
We've been looking at this issue for about the last 5 years with regular polling for Global News. And one of the things that strikes me is it that our attitudes are changing, or is it that people just are feeling more comfortable talking about their opinions on immigration in the public? I mean, certainly within Quebec, there is very lively discourse on the issue. But the thing that always strikes me And my rebuttal is always, but do people appreciate the alternative? If we didn't have immigration at the levels that we do, what would we look like as a nation? We'd have a declining population, first and foremost, because we just simply do not have enough children in Canada. Daryl Bricker always says you need a birth rate of 2.1, one for every man, one for every woman, and 0.1 for people who won't or can't. And I believe it's 1.8 in Canada. We will shrink without immigration. The implication, if we need to know the implications of that, I suppose we just need to ask our colleagues in Japan what a declining population looks like.
That's an excellent point. I think that Canadians support immigration very clearly. I mean, if you look at all of the numbers, they do. I think what you're starting to see now, even with the increased numbers, people haven't said, I don't hear a lot of that's too many and overall. It's not in a majority pushback. But I think they're starting to look at housing, healthcare, some of the systems, as you mentioned, Siam, and saying, okay, great, but what are we doing to accommodate them? And what's our plan forward on this, right? Yes, we need immigrants to boost the population size, but do we have a plan for how we're going to bring them in and not bring them into the country, but how we're going to have enough houses, healthcare services, et cetera, for everybody who's going to be here? Because one thing that Canadians are, is very clearly, there's a fairness that runs through them, which is fantastic. Once someone is here, they get the exact same benefits. There's a fairness, there's an equality, there's a desire up and down, right? So if we brought someone or they've come into the country, we're like, nope, same status, right? So no one wants two class of citizens. And I think they're very worried about some of those things.
Great point.
Okay, on to number 8. I got a great point. Thanks, Sean.
One for 8, Mike. Continue.
One for eight. More than 6 in 10 Canadians, 63.3%, want their lives to be simpler. And this is a kicker. They increasingly want to spend 62%. So I want a simpler life and I don't want anybody to be around me. That's 6 in 10 Canadians.
I think part of that's a byproduct of declining social cohesion. If I don't like my neighbors, why would I want to spend any time with them? You know, I think the pandemic showed a lot of people what a simpler life can look like because it was forced upon us. And a lot of people were, alone or just with their own immediate household for the better part of 2 years. And still some liked that. And I think, this winter, it just sort of seems that a lot of people are going back to hibernating and not going out in the winter anymore. And we used to blame it on the weather, but now we just kind of blame it on maybe there's a new kind of winter norm. We were used to just sitting in our homes watching Bridgerton and we're prepared to do that again. But, this, which seems like fairly superficial, is taking, Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone and magnifying it. What does it mean for restaurants? What does it mean for movie theaters? If people would rather be alone, they're going to work from home, they're not going to go to the office. What does it mean for downtowns? What does it mean for festivals, events, and sports teams? It seems like a fairly, frivolous stat, but I think the implications of it are quite profound.
Yeah, that's a lot to think about. And we certainly see a very interesting generational trend here, too. If you would have asked me, I would have guessed that, maybe older demographics were more likely to say that, I want life to be simpler or I want to, spend time alone. But that's not the case. It's younger people who increasingly want to spend time alone. And it's them who wish their lives to be simpler. And that sort of, makes me wonder that, social media has to be playing a part in that, right? Because, any statistics will tell you that, younger generations are spending up to 3 hours every day on social media, which means that, they have this sense of being connected with everyone around the world. But it's kind of, real friends versus real friends. I sit and share reels all day long with my Instagram friends, but are they my real friends? And it also has, consequences on mental health, feeling of inadequacy, stress, anxiety. So all of this has very profound implications on the society, on what our younger generations are feeling that, I know we want to talk about mental health. So I don't want to jump the gun, but it it definitely has a role to play in, I need this time alone. I want my life to be simpler. There's just so much being thrown at me with this, you know, constant scrolling, or I want to say swiping, but am I allowed to on an official podcast?
I can try to swipe Sean's bubble up here, but he's still there. And you know what? Those are all good points. And we're actually seeing it show up in some of the demographic change, right? Sean, you talked about having fewer children overall. Well, we're having fewer children because we're marrying later or we're partnering less. The most common and fastest growing type of household in Canada is a single person household. So you were actually starting to see this desire to be alone manifest, and I'm just going to be alone, right? And so all those implications you mentioned, Siam, are really going to be something we have a challenge to struggle going forward. You mentioned mental health, Siam, and so I'm going to mention two numbers that they aren't in opposition to each other, but I think are worth talking about at the same time. 81% of Canadians believe that they need to do more to look after themselves physically, like go to Hawaii and go for a run on the beach. And 7 in 10, there's a theme in this podcast, and 7 in 10 say they need to do the same thing for their mental well-being. And what we saw over the pandemic, as you know, I think we started to see it before the pandemic, the decline in stigma about people putting up their hand and say, yes, I'm struggling or I'm having some mental health challenges, and it started to open up. But the pandemic opened that wide open and people are like, no, I am having some challenges. And so they got on par. So what do you think about that with those numbers almost at the same level today?
Yeah, I want to go back to something that Sean was talking about, that, you know, the pandemic showed us what's possible. We were home, we had more time, and everybody was, you know, making videos on Instagram, exercising, showing their home hacks. It was like a trend that caught on, doing yoga at home. And all this new generation of Instagram influencers showed up, showing health hacks. So people did, they started taking control of their physical health. They had more time. They could do it. They could cook healthy food. They didn't have to, you know, just go for whatever takeaway they had on the way to work. So they cooked healthier food. They really got on top of things with their exercises regime, and they're not willing to give up. Everybody wants to go hybrid. Our data is, you know, clearly showing that. Yes, I know we still want face-to-face interactions. That's why I say hybrid and not, 100% work from home. So yes, people are feeling that they need to do more to look after their physical health, because that's something that, you know, they saw that they could do and they have to maintain that. And then we are talking about our mental well-being too. That's something that, you know, the awareness is greater than it ever was. And we have the pandemic to, you know, thank for that. I remember the days of the pandemic when we were doing our weekly sentiment tracking, and those charts that we drew about mental health challenges among men versus women, they were shocking. There was at least a 20-point gap. And when we, you know, drew the same graphs amongst parents or mothers, we saw that, you know, mothers were more likely to be facing addiction or mental health challenges. So the pandemic definitely, you know, got the spotlight onto the matter, and people are talking about it.
Yeah, I just see this as generally good news for two reasons. One, that figures are high and people are prepared to focus on their health. And the other is that mental health is very close to physical health. And, you know, I think you see it anecdotally. More people here in January and February seem to be cutting out alcohol, for example.
He's talking about himself.
I didn't cheat. I'm on day, I think, 27, and I didn't even cheat. And I'm looking forward to Hawaii.
Fine, Sean, I cheated. You just wanted me to admit I cheated on my no alcohol February already.
Okay, I want to flip to the last one. Over 7 in 10 Canadians, 72%, would like more control over the decisions that affect their own health.
Yeah, it seems that, you know, with some of the polling that's being released, has been released recently on the state of the healthcare system, assessments are deteriorating, Canadians want more strings attached to money, more accountability, all of these things, that the system is letting us down. And so why would you want to enter into a system that makes all the decisions for you when you just don't have confidence in the decisions or their ability to execute on those decisions? And I think this is one of the reasons why we're seeing such high levels of support for either privately provided but publicly funded, or people paying for their own treatments to get them faster or better treatment in a completely separate system. You know, money often means control for people. And so it's not surprising that a majority here just want to take the reins of their own health. They're more in tune with their own health. They're more in tune with the options available to them.
Yeah, I agree. And the only thing that I want to add here is, you know, sort of peripheral trends that are happening here. When the government cannot deliver, what's happening is, A, people want to take matters into their own hands, right? We've seen that the use of, you know, all these fitness apps, it's a booming business. People want to control their health, and they're doing it. They're going right ahead and doing it. The other thing we start to see is expectations from businesses are growing. It falls under the broader bucket of ESG, but we see that, you know, companies are, you know, taking this in their stride. They're helping their employees. They're, you know, giving benefits which are associated with health and fitness. So there is that expectation from businesses. Corporates are already acting on it, and they risk losing out and reputational issues if they don't act on it.
I think that the pandemic forced some behavior change. I don't think it did, obviously. The pandemic forced some behavior change, gave people more time, shifted our lifestyles, changed a whole bunch of things. And I think whether on purpose or just by happenstance, people are trying to hold on to the good parts of the pandemic. And by that, I mean more time for myself, looking after my physical well-being, spending more time with my family or by myself, depending on whatever drives you, makes you happy. So what you're seeing, I think, is, you know, and I anecdotally saw this when the pandemic hit. I stared at the look out my window at the road. Suddenly there were all kinds of people walking down the street every day because they had time. I haven't seen a drop off of people walking down the street post pandemic. So I think people got into those habits and they've held on to them. And now there's a bit of a pushback as the world saw these crises come in. We're fighting to hold on to the things that we did gain. There was a lot in the pandemic that we didn't like. We couldn't go see people. We couldn't do this. We couldn't do that. There's a whole range of things. Couldn't travel. But the sum of these things about our personal well-being, the way we felt more with a simpler life, those things, I think we're just trying to hold on to a little bits of that, that were forced behavior change, not give it all back.
Mike, I do want to hold on to my entire new wardrobe of athleisure clothes.
I have quite an outstanding collection of hoodies.
Excellent. All right. Well, you guys have any final thoughts before we jump off?
Well, only to say that this is just one slice of the global trends data, where we place Canada in the context of dozens of other countries around the world. So head to the Ipsos website, have a look at the data yourself. And there's so much in there that is worth discussing.
All right. Well, maybe we'll have another podcast and we'll dig in a little more to some of the specifics. But this was great. Thank you very much, both of you.
Oh, my pleasure, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Educated Conjecture. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts for another episode of Public Opinion and Informed Insights. If you have a comment, a suggestion, or a topic you'd like to see covered on an upcoming episode, please send us an email at publicaffairs@ipsos.com. That's publicaffairs@ipsos.com.